Book session number 13237, Reel 3.
Major Pitts, Reel 3. So you were saying that there was no feeling that they ought to be back in Australia defending their own country?
No, I certainly have no recollection of that whatsoever. None. Then I caught the desert disease, which was jaundice. Now, that is due to bad diet. And it was fairly prevalent. And it was evacuation straight away. Anybody with jaundice was shipped off at once. Because they couldn't treat it, you see. They couldn't treat it. They couldn't give you the right diet you needed. So I was pushed in onto a destroyer, back to Egypt, and I was in hospital in Egypt for quite a long time, recovering from jaundice.
What was the treatment for that?
I've forgotten. You had to have some... I think it was mainly dietary. I don't know much about jaundice, except that you... It's kidneys, isn't it? Jaundice. Either liver or kidneys. It's one of those two. I'm not sure which. But you've got to be very careful with it. I mean, if you don't treat it, it can become very serious. Which is why, that if you became inflicted with jaundice, you were immediately evacuated, just as if you'd had a leg blown off, just like that, you know. And then, I missed, because of that, I missed the thrust out of Tobruk. This was one of Auchinleck's. I think it was... I'm trying to remember the code name of it. I ought to know. It was Auchinleck's push from Egypt coinciding with a thrust from Tobruk.
This was not Crusader, was it?
Crusader. Or was that Wavell's last effort, Crusader?
I can't remember, actually.
I'm not sure that Crusader wasn't Wavell's last go. But anyway... I missed our attack there. But I must have gone back to the unit because I was evacuated eventually, or rather... No, I wasn't evacuated. I think we must have been... I can't for the life of me remember how the battalion got out of Egypt and onto a ship, if you please, for Rangoon. Which is the next phase in the next chapter in the story.
Just before we leave Tobruk, you were telling me about short supplies there. What were you just living on, bully beef and biscuits?
Oh, very much so. Oh, yes, very much so. And water was... I had to be very careful with water, as you can imagine. A chronic shortage... In a way, we weren't on starvation rations or anything like that. We had enough to live on, but we had to be careful.
Were there any civilians in Tobruk?
Well, we never saw them. I imagine there must have been in the town. Yes, there would have been. Oh, yes. But we were outside the town, you see. We were defending a sort of perimeter, probably 3 or 4 miles out of town. I mean, I have no recollection whatsoever of Tobruk as a place. I don't think I ever actually went into Tobruk at all, except to get onto a ship or off a ship.
Just desert and barbed wire?
Desert and barbed wire and concrete fortifications.
Was there much actual warfare whilst you were there on the perimeter?
Not a great deal, no. Again, it was skirmishing stuff. We pecked away at each other and fired a shot, a bit of shelling, a bit of bombing, a bit of everything, you know. But no actual major conflict, because both we were in siege, as you understand, and the German wasn't strong enough to pierce the perimeter and take the place. Not at that point. Later on, Tobruk was taken.
Why was it necessary to have a British liaison officer with the Australians?
Can't imagine. I have no idea. I have no idea. I can't remember really what liaising I did, but I know I lived very happily with a battalion headquarters of an Australian unit, and it was extremely interesting.
So you just functioned as an Australian officer?
Yes, I suppose I carried messages or... I can't recollect doing anything except sitting hours on end, nattering away to these Aussies. It was... there were many worse jobs, I can tell you.
So you didn't have to go out and patrol?
I don't remember patrolling with them. I may have done. Yeah, I suppose I did, yes. I presume, yes, I think I did. But it was all fairly long-range stuff, because, as I say, the Germans hadn't got the oomph to take us on, really. We were containing them very comfortably at that point.
Now, you said that, I think it was in February 1942, you left the Middle East for the...
That's right.
Far East.
Yeah. Well, we got on to the Mauritania. No, was it the Mauritania? Yes, the Mauritania.
This is the second York and Lenx again.
That's right. This was the new Mauritania, as she was. I think she was only launched just before the war. And one interesting thing there was the difference between going on a troop ship now to what it had been when I first went out in 1940. Now it was eight officers to a small cabin, you know, cramped up in bunks, tiered up. And, it was a very different situation. Very, very different.
Was it any worse for the troops?
No, not much. We were all in the... The main difference was that we were all in the suit. It wasn't a very comfortable voyage. I don't think we were attacked during the voyage. Now, the point is, of course, that apparently we were destined for Rangoon, for Burma, to try and stop the Japs. We, being a division, I think we were 70 div. We were certainly 14th Infantry Brigade of 70 div, that's right. And we were pushed out of Egypt in order to try and do something about the catastrophes in Burma. But luckily for us, in a sense, the Japs got into Rangoon when we were still sailing across the Indian Ocean. And so instead of being thrust into what would have been a catastrophic military situation and probably put straight in the bag by the Japs, we were offloaded at Bombay. So you might say that was a stroke of good fortune for us. Because I can't imagine we would have been able to put right a situation which was hopelessly out of control. So we land at Bombay and we spend a few days there, and then we do a marvellous cross-India trek in a divisional convoy, if you please.
By road?
Yes. You can imagine how slow a divisional convoy was. Unless you've actually experienced an army convoy moving, you've no idea how tortoise-like it is. And when you had literally hundreds of vehicles strung over a huge area, must have been, across one single road, you can imagine how slow it was. I was MTO of my battalion at this time. A thoroughly bad appointment, because I hadn't the faintest idea what happened underneath the bonnet of a vehicle. But they made me MTO, typical. And they didn't have time to send me on a course to learn.
We should say this is a transport officer.
Yeah. I suppose M stood for mechanical or motor transport. MT, motor transport, mechanical transport. They didn't have time to send me on a course to learn what happened underneath. But, of course, it was mainly administrative. One had a very good technical sergeant who was a Remy attached. Or Ordnance. Would he be Ordnance or Remy? One of the two. He was an expert. And he was your technical man. He had a technical staff. So, in fact, you were simply acting as a commander, if I hesitate to use the word, of this group of chaps, of whom a small proportion would be highly technical and will be dealing with all mechanical problems.
What kind of image did the Japanese soldier have at that time?
I suspect that we didn't at that time know about the appalling cruelties, if you follow me, and the atrocities. I don't think we knew about that at the time. I think all we knew about was that they were pretty good. Results were staring us in the face. That they were damn good at jungle warfare, that they knew how to get off the roads and get into the scrub, and were playing rings around us. I think we suspected we were up against something pretty good, pretty tough. Whether we knew about the other side, treatment of prisoners and so on, I don't know. I can't think we could have done.
Did any memorable incidents happen to you on that journey across India?
No, nothing particular. One had a very interesting time, because as motor MTO, I spent most of it on a motorcycle, going up and down the convoy, making sure everything was all right. So I whizzed backwards and forwards against this crocodile-like convoy, covering about 70 miles a day. Ridiculous. It took, I think, the best part of 2 to 3 weeks to get across from Bombay to the Ranchi area. Now, when we got to the Ranchi area, we were put out into the jungle, into pup tents. We were living in little bivouacs.
What's a pup tent?
Pup tents. I suppose it would be some sort of slang for a bivouac. I mean, I lived in a bivouac, just big enough to take myself. And that's how we were. I mean, there was a mess tent and the store tents and headquarter tents and so on, but we were camped in the jungle, in the Ranchi area. And there we were being prepared for Chindit Operation Number 2. Which, of course, is something one didn't know about at the time. While we were there, a colonel arrived from the parachute regiment, recruiting, trying to pinch officers and men. So I thought, well, it might be rather fun to do this. So I went and had a chat with him. It was a man called Martin Lindsay, who ultimately became a Member of Parliament. Colonel Martin Lindsay. And had a chat with him. And he said, right, you're in. And so I went off. Left my York and Lancs. And that was the end last I saw of them.
Did that create any ill feeling amongst the senior officers of your regiment?
No, possibly relief, I don't know. No, not at all. I think they thought I was slightly balmy. So you're going off to be an effing paratrooper, are you? No, there wasn't any of that. They were quite nice about it. So they probably were rather relieved, I don't know.
What was the attraction for you? The Paris.
Well, I think I just thought it would be something more interesting to do than what I was doing at the time. And I think I was rather fed up with... You see, I'd done really very little except just be a platoon commander. Those postings that I had were only a matter of a few weeks to the Australians and to the Cretans in Crete. The rest of it was all rather humdrum platoon commander. Well, I was MTO, and for a brief time, I think I was intelligence officer. IO. I did various odd jobs within the battalion, but I was glad to get a change, I think. No more or less. My God, what a change it was.
In what way?
Well, I arrive in Delhi to join this unit, and I find them living in a state of total luxury. I mean, it was quite staggering. They were living in wonderful quarters. Peacetime, army, cantonments. It's all there, actually, in that thing of mine. Can I have a look at it a minute?
This is the 151
Para. That's right, 151 Para. 151, there was an Indian battalion, a British battalion, and a Gurkha battalion, comprising a parachute brigade. But we were terribly short of aircraft. I mean, there wasn't anything like sufficient aircraft. Nothing like sufficient aircraft to do any form of airborne exercise. Airborne, i.e. to do a jump and then operate on exercise. Not a hope. Such dropping facilities as existed at that time in the subcontinent were a few old Wellingtons or Hudsons with a hole cut in them operating at Rawalpindi, where all the new recruits to the parachute regiment were sent to do their initial jumps, their training jumps, and in other words, converting them from infanteers into parachutists. I think you had to do 7 jumps. And once you'd done your 7, then you got your wings. And you wore your wings. Became a parachutist. That all happened at Pindi. And those were the only dropping facilities in India at the time. The battalion I joined was, as I say, luxuriously accommodated. The officers' mess was magnificent. We dined not in mess kit, but in the finest that we could dig up with our bearer. I'll give you an idea of how sort of pompous it all was. Our personal bearer, accoutred magnificently with term, would stand behind each officer's place in order to look after his master. And that was how we were living. Total luxury. And you see, my position was odd, because there arrives onto this scene this rather, I don't know how they viewed it, but a creature who'd already seen the rough edge of the war, you know, sand dropping out of his boots, desert sand, all that nonsense. I had a gong, which made it worse for them in a way. I got a Greek award. And here he arrives, you see. Not one of the other officers of the battalion had ever seen a shot fired in action. The one or two who'd seen service on the frontier, a famous character called Dickie Lonsdale, who became, well, very well known. He had got the MC for gallantry in one of the Afghan campaigns before the war, frontier campaigns. He was a company commander in the battalion. But most of them were regulars, and most of them hadn't yet seen any action at all. And this callow little brute arrives with 2 pips on its shoulder. But they were awfully good about it. I mean, they might have sort of cold-shouldered me completely and thought of me as a damn nuisance, arriving and sort of throwing his weight around. But no, they were awfully good. And I had nothing but pleasant memories.
How did you cope with the para-training?
Well, there wasn't any para-training. It was soft.
None whatsoever?
Well, there was nothing parachute about it because there were no aircraft to drop us. So you can forget about all that. I mean, we did do some exercises, but they were very, very gentlemanly. I mean, if we did a night exercise, oh my word, a night exercise, we probably did one about one a week at the most, and that would be cause a lot of grumbling because it would interfere with... No, I mean, the whole attitude was totally relaxed. I can't tell you what it was like. But the interesting thing is that a lot of those officers subsequently either went down and out completely at Arnhem or won reputations for themselves for notably gallant Dickie Lonsdale made a great name for himself. George Lee became General Sir George Lee eventually, with a lot of distinguished service. He died about a year ago, George Lee. And he was a company commander in that battalion. Splendid chap. Jeff Powell, who made a reputation for himself as a soldier, and then, when he left the army, made a reputation as a writer, and has written, arguably, the best book on Arnhem. Was yet on to be seen. I think he was a second in command of a company when I joined. So there was some very, very good stuff around, I can promise you.
At this time in India, coming on to Indian politics, it was the time of...
Yes, absolutely. Now, I'm glad you mentioned that, because the nearest thing we got to anything even faintly unpleasant during our Delhi days with 151, was when we sallied out to deal with civil unrest, as it was called. Because Gandhi was making a decidedly dynamic impression on his fellow Indians, and they were putting up a spirited opposition. That was a dreary sort of affair, because there was very little you could do about it. You see, you were not allowed to shoot at anyone. If you wanted to open fire, you first of all had to get written permission, and I'm not joking, written permission from a magistrate before you were allowed to fire at the mob that was threatening you.
What were the mobs doing?
Nothing very much. I mean, in terms of what one has seen on television over the last 30 years, any time over the last 30 years, I think it was probably pretty tame. They were making rude noises and chucking the odd stone, but they weren't particularly effective. But there was rioting, and certain places needed protecting. And this is what we went down to Delhi to do.
Were they damaging property?
Yes, I should think so. I can't remember an awful lot about it, except how frightfully frustrating it was that one's hands were so tired in cleaning things up. We didn't have tear gas or anything like that.
What did the general attitude of Indians seem that you came across seem to be towards the British?
Well, to be quite honest, I didn't really meet any Indians at all at that time. The only Indians I saw were the people on the cantonment, the batmen and those servants and, you know, the chaps hanging around the barracks selling lemonade to the troops and cleaning their boots for them and all that sort of thing, which they did. And even the troops had a little lad looking after them. Incredible. Peacetime soldiering, in a way. The only thing that was different when there weren't any white women around. Otherwise, it was exactly like, I imagine, an Indian peacetime station. I think they just abandoned their polo sticks before I arrived. But only just.
How long did this life in Delhi go?
Not very long, because I must have joined there about... I shouldn't think I was there for more than about 2 or 3 months, when suddenly everything started to boil. And we were put on a ship again, sent back to the Middle East. So I come from Suez, I go back to Suez, this time with a parachute unit.
This is the whole of the 151...
The whole brigade. Shan Hackett was our brigadier, the famous Shan Hackett. Wonderful commander too, marvellous chap.
Why was he so good?
Oh, what a good question. Because he's a most unusual man, in that he'd taken a very, very good degree at Oxford, and he'd done a B.Lit while he was a subaltern in Palestine. He was a scholar, an absolute master of the English language in terms of speech. He was wonder, his talks were wonderful, and he was a very human and delightful person. I mean, you of all the senior officers whom I met during the war, he's the one who made far and away the greatest impression on me. The others, well, no, not much. But he was something rather special.
Where did you go to in the Middle East?
Well, we were in Palestine. They put us into Palestine to train. And we got a very good CO. We had a CO called Colonel Socks Hose. I suppose you spell Socks, S-O-X. He was a very gallant fellow from the Beds and Hearts. But he was absolutely no good as a CO. He collected a very good DSO as a company commander with the Bedfords. But the poor chap just couldn't handle a parachute battalion at all. So he was quietly removed, and we got a tremendous character from the guards. I think he was a Coldstream. Lieutenant Colonel Sir Richard Davout. Bart. And a very, very good soldier indeed. And he transformed the battalion. He turned it into a very, very good battalion. It changed its name. It became 156. It was 151, it became 156.
And this is where you got your true parachute experience?
Yes, yes.
Did you have any problems with it?
No, not really. I was lucky I didn't, in that I didn't have any bad landings or anything like that. No horror stories on that one. Except that awful business of watching the... This is back in India, watching the stick doing their first jump, and we were due to jump that evening. They were jumping about 4 o'clock, and the first chap out, his parachute didn't open, and he sort of thudded at our feet, and he was younger even than I was, and he was the only other officer on the course. There were two young officers of whom I was one, and he was first out of his stick, and I was going to be first out of my stick. You follow? There were about 8 in a stick, about that. There was a course of 16 of us, 2 officers and 14 other ranks. And this lad, and you know, one had shared a room with him, had lunch with him that day. It was rather awful.